Okay, we continue with the conceptual framework, and I believe now that we're going to have an open session where even more than you before, you're free to bring up whatever you want. Do we need any introduction to this? I suppose not. Are there any issues around the conceptual framework that you would like to bring up? Equal.
Okay, I don't know what I should start from. regarding the prudence, I'm sorry raising this again, but I think it is not realistic talking about prudence in the particular sections like recognition or measurement. So maybe prudence should be dealt in the section of objective. But you already eliminated the prudence notion. We are not necessarily opposing that, but at least basis for conclusion should be modified, because what we want to do is not to expand the role of prudence, but we need to make the reason for the accounting treatment currently existing, such as the lower of cost or market impairment and onerous contract, day one loss, but and also we don't have the other way around method. If we can explain that with the notion of relevance, faithful representation, and neutrality, that's fine. But it's very doubtful. So some kind of prudence may be existing. So people in the world think so. So I think best place is to be included in the basis for conclusion of the object section.
Roger? I'd share that view, and actually talking to Mary in the interval, I think the issue is actually about prudence and recognition. I think people have a lot of different meanings of prudence, and they often think about prudence and measurement. I did actually think the advocates of prudence are arguing for prudence and measurement. They're not arguing for deliberately inflated reserves, for example. I think prudence and recognition would suggest that you're quicker to recognise losses than you are to recognise gains. And I think that's where the debate should be, and I think it would be very useful in the basis of conclusions if the ISB explained quite clearly why they had decided to abandon that and what the consequences were. But actually, I wanted to raise a different issue, which is to go back to a comment that Francois made yesterday morning about financial reporting more generally. And I know that this project is not about solving all of those problems, but I think it would be helpful to explain where financial statements fit within the context of financial reporting more generally, and most importantly, what fits within financial statements and what fits outside financial statements. Because otherwise, things could fall into financial statements which perhaps should more properly be outside, or vice versa. And I do think we need to know more widely where financial statements do fit in to make that decision.
Yeah, we have got some discussion about already in there in the papers we discussed last month, I guess it was, and the next version that will be coming to the board next month.
Leslie?
Just related to the papers we were just discussing, but issues that were not teed up for discussion particularly, I just wanted to raise a couple of points about the discussion of derecognition. It's possibly one of the most controversial issues that we have dealt with. It is of extreme importance to investors. And depending on the point in the economic cycle, we find that their preferences with regard to how to address the issue fluctuate. And so I think this is one area where there should be more guidance in the conceptual framework about how we should think about issues relating to derecognition. There were a few different alternatives included, for example, disclosure, presenting any rights retained, or treating the whole thing as an obligation without any explanation of how you might decide between those alternatives. And I'm personally not comfortable leaving that decision to the standards level without some further explanation of how you might think about deciding between those. And I also think that Roger made this point earlier, but this is an area where I think we need, to the extent we can, to inform those criteria or the way we would think about it by the way users are thinking about the issue of retained risk. The other point I wanted to make, changing the subject completely, has to do with the discussion of distinguishing between liabilities and equity. And I cannot actually speak for our board on this because, as you know, in our discussions to date, they've been extremely inconclusive. But I was wondering about the basis for the suggestion that equity claims should be remeasured. It's neat information. I mean, I think it's interesting information. It's something we had thought about disclosing at a point in time, which we did not pursue. But what wasn't clear to me is how it solved the problems that exist today with regard to the model. It seems to me it raises a slew of new questions about how you would apply the approach to different types of contracts. And I think in the end, that's what caused us to not be able to complete the previous project is sort of unsatisfactory answers with regard to the framework. So I was hoping to have a little bit of discussion about how this idea came about and why you think it's responsive to the questions that have been plaguing us in this area.
Yeah, and the first thing I should say about that probably is, because Mary will say it very quickly if I don't, is when we said remeasurement, we were thinking quite broadly there. So that includes not just what you might think of as a current measurement, but it also includes reallocations within total equity. So let's make sure we get that possible misunderstanding. Right, so it's not necessarily a fair value or any kind of other kind of current value. The starting point really was looking at the definitions of liabilities and our existing definitions and the way we've developed the definition as well. And none of the approaches that seem to have been considered seriously in the past actually seem that consistent with the existing definitions. So that suggests that either the approaches are wrong or the definitions are wrong. Using the existing definition seemed like quite a good starting point in a way. And it seemed like that part of the problems with the existing approaches was that it was trying to deal with at least a two-dimensional problem and collapsing it down into a one-dimensional distinction between equities and liability. And the two dimensions are you obliged to pay cash or transfer some other financial economic resource, or does this instrument affect the cash that other instrument holders are going to get out? Is there some knock-on effects on them? And so the thinking really was maybe we should separate those two dimensions. And so the existing definition of a liability doesn't seem too bad. It's an obligation to pay cash. That's, you know, man in the street can probably understand that. And so then the sort of logical next step was then, well, if everything's in equity, we ought to differentiate them somehow and give some information about the effects that one instrument has on other instruments. So that was the idea behind it.
Kevin?
Each of the areas that Leslie raised were also on my list, and I can't see what you're playing with there, solving the debt versus equity issue. If there's validity in that, I would have seen it as a disclosure aspect. And I think where those types of proposals have failed in the past is that you don't end up actually measuring the economic position of the relative parties. And unless all you're doing is multiplying their interest by the current market price, so why go there? They can do that. One area that is sort of subliminal in the framework and it needs to be thought about, and maybe this area we've just been talking about is an example of it, is common information needs of users. We can talk about the needs of users, but you could plumb the depths of those needs on each user category. And in the past, we've said, no, we don't try to do that. We're trying to get to the common information needs. People might have a different purpose for the information, but they have a common information need. I don't see that anywhere mentioned in what you've done. And when you come back to this question of gains and losses by categories of shareholders, why would you be calculating their gains and losses and not calculating the change in economic position of a creditor when things move against them or for them? So it seems to me to be a bit unfaithful to the objectives. The third thing I wanted to say, and it reflects where I started yesterday in saying I'm a bit concerned about not stepping back far enough from the accounting responses to try and work out what the aggregative effects of or aggregative characteristics of entities are and changes in those characteristics. So let me read you six headings, which I think are the generics of any entity. Its capacity to provide goods or services under its current mandate or business model. Its capacity to fund the current mandate or business model and meet their debts when due. The capacity to sustain that current mandate or business model. The capacity to sustain the current funding model. The capacity of an entity to change its mandate or business model. And the capacity to finance that change. They're not all of equal relevance to any particular entity, but I think they are all characteristics that entities have. Now, I will publish a paper shortly that explains that idea, and all I'm saying is you can characterise an entity around a certain number of stocks. The aggregate of those stocks might be what you call financial position, a phrase that we use but we very seldom define. And so going back to Hans's question yesterday of performance in this paper, I say changes in each of those stocks is financial performance for the period and that the income statement is one part of that change. Generalising it, I think our discussion where we try to take the measurement selection on an asset or a liability to the cash outcome is a bit narrow. I'm not saying it's wrong, but if somebody said to you, okay, the answer is we'll give you a spreadsheet with all the cash flows and cells, and you can add them up or multiply them by whatever factors you like, would you be happy? And the answer is no. It's not just the cash flow. It's the aggregate effects of that economically that you're trying to get. And I think between the objectives of the framework and the levels we've been talking about in this last 2 days, there's a missing level. It's the contention I have. So I'll publish something that on that shortly. The other thing, and I don't want to seem to blindside the IASB, but we will be publishing a monograph on liabilities shortly, which Warren and one of my staff have written. It's some 150-page type document. It covers most of the topics we've been talking about or are in the papers. It wasn't designed to preempt the discussion paper or anything else. It started quite a while ago. And I just want you to take it that was the outcome of our concerns about liabilities, and that's why we're publishing it. Hopefully it will be helpful for the debate.
Kim?
Thank you. Yeah, I'd just like to reiterate the point that Roger made in terms of, you know, making sure that it's clear where financial statements fit in also in light of integrated reporting and other types of financial reporting and making financial statements more relevant, because I think that there's some concern that perhaps they're not that relevant anymore. So I do think that that's an important point to note. Then a couple of other points which, yes, while they might sound rather specific, I would think that they should be addressed in the conceptual framework. I mentioned the one yesterday around non-arm's length transactions, and I don't know whether or not the conceptual framework is that explicit around, you know, the requirement to identify more than one transaction. And again, perhaps to give you an example of where the concern comes from is if, for example, the subsequent measurement is going to be cost, then, you know, could there be a tendency not to account for all aspects of a transaction? If you just simply say, well, cost was the nominal amount paid or received, and therefore there's nothing else which requires me to consider something else. Obviously, if the measurement was going to be fair value, then it sort of forces one in. But I sort of think that maybe something needs to be addressed before one gets into measurement. The requirement, is there a requirement to identify all aspects of a transaction, if particularly it isn't on an arm's length basis? And then other sort of, when I say pervasive concepts, I think something which has been coming up, you know, a fair bit recently, is when are payments made or received in advance implicit funding? And again, I think that's something which is pervasive. I mean, it can have, you know, been all different types of transactions. And I think there, again, going back to the point I've been making around consistency, is that I think something like this should be in the conceptual framework in terms of if a customer pays in advance for something, you know, is that therefore a loan or is it simply a right to receive a non-financial item? You know, the revenue project is addressing it a little bit from the supplier's side. I sort of think that something like that I would expect should be a principle in the conceptual framework. And then also something else, which is, I guess, you know, been an issue recently, is determining perhaps what is cost when there are variable payments or contingent amounts. So, and again, I think, you know, thinking has evolved, you know, particularly under current business combination accounting, we tend to take the fair value at the date of acquisition, you know, thinking about contingent purchase consideration, any other adjustments are not regarded as changes to cost. Yet in some other aspects, people would say, but, you know, those are just re-estimates of the amount that I have to pay. So I sort of call those kind of pervasive concepts to say that I would think that perhaps those really should be entrenched in the conceptual framework to then inform decisions at a standard level.
Clement?
Yeah, six comments. The first one, we echo the earlier comment about, you know, prudence. We understood that that the reason for eliminating that as part of the revision in 2010, but in view of the concept being used so often in standard setting process, we think that it is our will that it will be there will be value in providing further clarity about prudence that should be considered in the context of neutrality. The second comment is, I think, it's very important for IASB to develop guidance in determining the unit of accounts for recognition and measurement purpose. The third comment about the tentative decision of IASB for defining profit and loss in the presentation chapter. We think that it's also important to define that for the element in the conceptual framework, because providing definition about profit and loss will be conducive to promoting the discussion at the measurement chapter. And on the the distinction between gains, revenue, losses, and expenses, we understand the tight timeline that you are facing, but given the proposed development of a conceptual basis for OCI, I think it's very important to also look at the distinction between revenue income and losses and expenses in that context. The other comment is about the distinction between liabilities and equity. I think the first one under this area would be the proposed presentation of wealth transfer between different category of equity holders. We think that actually might change the emphasis to the angle of equity holder rather than the entity. You know, if the presentation is skewed towards that angle. And the second comment is about the allowance for certain equity instrument to be remeasured. We aware that the remeasurement is not prohibited at present, but however, formalizing a difference between the residual claim and other equity claim will change the nature of equity altogether. So again, you know, that needs to be thought of in more detail. And lastly, on the presentation, under the presentation and disclosure side, we in the March meeting, ISB tentatively concluded that there's no financial statements has a primacy over the other primary statements. But however, in our view, the statement of financial position and statement of comprehensive income should preside over the others. And the second point is about the boundary of notes to financial statements. The tentative decision of ISB now actually is on the notes to the financial statements should focus on the information about the entity's existing resources and obligation. And then as far as the information to do with future, you would like to see it in the context of management commentary. But as far as the future information is concerned, we think that if the information is to the future is to do with transactions pertaining to transactions, events, and situations that have occurred before the reporting period, we think that it could be incorporated in the notes to the financial statements. Whereas for the information that is to do with transactions and events that is occurring after the reporting year, then you know it's okay to include in the management commentary.
Could I ask a question, Clement? you were asking for some discussion of the distinction between revenue and other income and gains and losses and expenses, and you said in context of OCI, was it just about defining what's going in profit and loss versus what's in OCI, or was it some other type of distinction you were looking for a guidance on as well?
I think it's more to do with within the context of OCI.
Okay.
Yeah, the definition between income and gains and losses and expenses are not very clear.
Yeah. On your last point, by the way, on that point about forward-looking information, I mean, I think a lot of the board were confused by the wording in that as well. And I think the intention was it was anything to do with the existing resources and obligations is fair game for the notes. Anything that's beyond the existing resources and obligations is really going to be management commentary.
Yeah, correct.
Councillor Isaac?
A few issues have been discussed in our preparatory meeting. When we considered whether subsequent measurements should drive initial measurement, in fact, two main comments arose. Basically, there was agreement with this direction, but a comment was made, in fact, that linked back to what Leslie said yesterday about the experience gained from applying IFRS 13. The fair value guidance, So the view among us was that whatever form of cash-based measurement is used, the transaction price should be considered as the best reflection of the current price at the purchase date, unless you have some evidence to the contrary. But that should be really the point where to start. And I think it fits well with what Leslie told us yesterday. When we discussed cost, also the question arose whether cost should include acquisition costs. That's probably something that it would be worth tackling in the paper. When we looked at the definition of a liability and the way the guidance, its various approaches, frankly, people did not understand the approach to rate. So it was difficult to assess it, assess its benefit, because we just don't understand how it works, and more particularly where it stops. Other than that, we discussed economic compulsion, it's not clear to people that the case is made to eliminate economic compulsion from the guidance on liability, so maybe it should be pursued further. When we discussed debt equity, and with one point I want to make, probably Liesl is going to address that more particularly. And in fact, we made the link between debt equity and discussion, and what you should be doing about reporting entity. There is not much appetite, frankly, to see what has been done so far on reporting entity being anyway in the paper, if the intention is not to move the discussion further. However, there is a link between the conclusion you reach the reporting entity and the debt equity distinction. So having some discussion around the entity view or the parent company view and the possible interrelationships with the definition, the distinction between liability and equity, that's the part of the discussion that people see usefulness. One point, in fact, that arises from the discussions that we have had today, I think it would be good to have some discussions. You know, you've brought, and it's been supported and seen as very positive, that now you look at giving some relevant information, taking the stewardship perspective. You've seen the discussion that Kevin and I have had, more or less. What are the possible consequences, of considering stewardship? So, in a way, if people are content that you're going to consider it, but have completely different understandings of what that means for you to consider it, we're not going to have made much progress, because the next step, misunderstandings are going to arise again. So probably some discussions around what are the consequences there. What is the? How do you translate that objective at conceptual level is needed. And finally, it's a comment that I already made, but I would like very much emphasize the expectation from the revision of the conceptual framework is those expectations are very high. In terms of people having a clear understanding how the standard setting discussions are going to develop in the future. The fact that there are decisions that will be made at standard level and that will be made differently from standard is certainly something that in a certain number of cases makes sense, if not always. But when you come to that conclusion, bring guidelines, reasoning to indicate on what basis your choice is going to be made at standard level. Bringing that clarity is very important. And finally, the comment is not on the content, but on the process. People cannot see how to provide a reasonable input to such an important project in less than 6 months.
Less than 6 months?
Yeah, in other words, there is the request for having a 6 month comment period.
Oh, I think we will have that. Were we thinking about 120 days?
We were talking about 40 days. 40 days.
Five for everyone.
We were thinking about 4 months.
And we're talking about 6.
Or at least 31st of December.
Well, it depends on the publication date. So.
Equal.
Okay, let me start with the correction of my last remark. I talked about prudence and asked to modify the basis for conclusion of objective, but it's a qualitative characteristics, obviously. The reason why I misstated I thought I talked about objective and internally generated goodwill. When the goodwill passed the definition test, then both acquired goodwill and the internally generated goodwill passed the test. But you mentioned that internally generated goodwill does not pass a cost-benefit test. I think there are lots of reasons not to recognize internally generated goodwill, so I don't deny this reason, but I think the central reason is that the relationship with objective. Objective 7 said of the conceptual framework says that general purpose financial reporting are not designed to show the value of reporting entity, but they provide information to help users to estimate the value of the reporting entity. Recognizing internally generated goodwill is itself to assess the value of the reporting entity. So that's why I think internally generated goodwill will be denied to be recognized. Second one is about disclosure, 5A, paper 5A, paragraph 32 referred about cohesiveness. I heard you may change this wording, but this wording reminds us the past financial statement presentation project. So cohesiveness among flow information and stock information is quite difficult. Also, cohesiveness may arise, may come back to discussion about direct method of cash flow statement. So, we would like to avoid this wording. Thirdly, the derecognition. As we totally support the Leslie's comment. Simply, the derecognition is a mirror of recognition. It's just simple. But maybe we have to explore more. That may involve the unit of accounts issued, like a component, or that may involve the recognition of new assets. So it's not so simple so in the accounting treatment. If it's not simple in the accounting treatment, so concepts should be explored more. Then the fourth point is we support Clement remark statement of financial position and statement of comprehensive income, presiding cash flow statement or something else. but I personally don't care that it includes everything, but if it is included, the presiding those two statements than others are obvious. So that's why we don't say that. That's a reason.
I didn't understand you.
Okay. I don't care. I don't ask to change the wording. But we have to know, or it's obvious that the statement of statement of financial position and the statement of comprehensive income, precise cash flow statement. At least the conceptual framework base.
You mean that's in hierarchy?
Yeah.
And cash flows is below the other two.
Right. So we don't have to.
Otherwise, we wouldn't need accounting.
Nothing to be discussed about the cash flow statement. We know what the cash is.
Yeah. Visual.
Probably three areas. Relatively briefly, when we talk about the purpose of the framework, I think we have to remind ourselves that there is something in IS 8, which means that preparers are supposed to look at the framework in certain circumstances. And having conflicts between the framework and standards and making preparers look at the framework which is unchanged after major debates on concepts gives a certain tension. People have already even alluded to maybe having to remove this reference in IS 8, and people debate very much what we do with the framework for the standard setters, and of course you've always had the difference between the FASB's approach and your approach, and I don't think this issue should be totally blended out in the next few months. It is there somehow. The next issue would then be, again, of course, about not yet debt equity, that's the last one, the financial statements and the financial reporting. Someone in Germany phrased it to the extent that you would have to withdraw parts of IFRS 7 if you were so serious about just having financial statements and having in the notes only sort of notes explaining what you have in the statements and only having current resources and things like that. Because in IFRS 7, to our understanding at least, you go across the border to a certain risk reporting, which if you take the notion of what you want to do very seriously, you really had to withdraw parts of IFRS 7, which we would not really support, to make that clear. And of course, we've always been very adamant that management report is part of the package and so forth and whatever, but I don't have to go into that. Then about the debt equity splits, I would have more or less phrased it the way Leslie has. What you have been debating in the sort of statement of equity changes doesn't address at least two of the issues we have to feel very strongly about at all. And these two, just for argument's sake, I call them pressure points, are, on the one hand, how you arrive at the result and how you then think you can distribute the result. I vividly remember someone phrasing it that you have to design financial instruments possibly to the effect that for tax purposes you can deduct the servicing and that for commercial reporting you can dress it up as equity, which gives you sort of the direction where people want to go, to have both, to have the cake and eat it, to have both the tax deductibility of the servicing, but on the other hand for your key ratios, the equity effect. And this effect on the income statement, you don't touch on that in your changes of equity, of course. The other one is we've seen some wording which irritates us, always been not too convinced that you have some equity in separate financial statements that may be changed to liability when you come to consolidation. Because you say something about it ranking in a certain way,
And of course, consolidated financial statements, at least in most parts of the world, as far as I'm aware, are not really the basis for winding up something. And winding up something, of course, gives you a certain hierarchy. I think our understanding of equity in the consolidated financial statements has to be developed a little further, and it would probably or hopefully lead to a better understanding that this sort of winding up notion is not what we're talking about when we distinguish between debt and equity. Because, again, if you have something as an equity instrument in a subsidiary and in the consolidated financial statement, it just suddenly becomes a liability. That's a very difficult to understand notion. And our understanding, what we mean by equity in consolidated financial statements, we add things which for certain aspects you shouldn't add. But if we want to depict the group, I think we usually very loosely, I think, see things as equity. So moving between different classes of equity holders is an interesting concept, but doesn't really touch on what the problems we had before. Adds a new dimension, which complicates things too, and it does touch on going from more of an entity theory to more of an interest theory, which I think the board always try to avoid, to state if you're more in the entity camp or more in the interest camp. And the more or less minor repair or maintenance on IAS 28 and IAS 27 and IFRS 10 and IFRS 11, at least definitely in the European debate, has brought it forward that the understanding of a common basis of either the entity theory or the interest theory would bring us a more obvious route where to go, because what you have changed now or proposed to change seems to go sometimes into a different direction than IFRS 10 tends to go. And again, with all due respect for repair and maintenance, if there was a better common basis, I think it would be easier for people to understand.
Anna?
Yes. I was wondering if a conceptual framework could say something on transactions between entities belonging to the same group, related parties. If we apply the same principle as the rest of the transactions, especially regarding measurement, because these transactions are not treated in the standards, and there are some standards, for example, IFRIC 17, that excludes this kind of transactions between related parties. I'm thinking also about business combination under common control. Maybe the conceptual framework could introduce certain basic principles that then afterwards could be developed by a standard on business combination under common control or other transactions between related parties.
Alexander?
Two quick comments. I appreciate very much the attempt and your effort to distinguish constructive obligation versus economic compulsion. I think it's very important in differentiating equity and liabilities. And so I have two quick comments. And it's on page 20 of Agenda Reference Page 2A. I think it's worth to make it clear when the attributes are cumulative, because it gets lost in translation and got to other languages, and semicomma doesn't mean exactly the same thing, so people tend to translate it literally. And I don't know if this, in the conceptual framework, it's the appropriate place to put it, but somewhere must be clear that dividend policies are or are not economic compulsion, because that came every time on differentiating equity and liabilities. Some notes pay interest, etc., if a company pays dividends over the minimum amount. They say, well, I don't have to pay dividends over the minimum amount. That's economic compulsion. Yes, but we have been paying this over the last 30 years. So it's a really economic compulsion. I think it would be interesting to. Another thing is So I believe this is very important to be clarified, that difference. The second one is about prudence. I don't know how far you are in the discussion of eliminating prudence from the conceptual framework, but I personally disagree with that, and there is a strong body of academic literature favoring prudence/conservatism on a contractual basis, because academic literature tends to differentiate the informative nature of accounting and the contractual use of accounting, and how prudence and conservatism is important from a contractual point of view. So the use of accounting information in covenants, use of accounting information in remuneration, arrangement. So I think at least that those arguments should be considering. I know that prudence is everywhere in the standards. The fact that this is not on the conceptual framework does not mean that it has been taken out of the standards. But I really agree that it's an important qualitative characteristic of accounting, of high quality accounting information.
Mary?
Alessandro, question. Your first point about dividend policies are not economic compulsion.
Yep.
I take the point that that is a significant point for debt equity classification.
Yes.
I was curious as to why you thought it should be resolved in the conceptual framework, addressed in the conceptual framework, as opposed to thinking about that in the context of a debt equity standards level project.
Because I believe that you're going to distinguish constructive obligation and economic compulsion in the conceptual framework.
I think it's one of the things we are looking at, whether we should address the, you know, whether or not economic compulsion is relevant generally.
Yeah, and my point, I believe it is. It's important. That detail about about dividend policy, okay, maybe going to be in the standard, not on the conceptual framework, but I at least those things should be consistent. No? Because the way to look at let us see here, say, as a result of entity's past actions, the autopath can reasonably rely on the entity. What does it mean? Because I can understand dividend policy on relying on the entity because he's been acting on that way for the last 20 years. Maybe I rely on the entity to pay me dividends. So it's sometimes dividend policy is not written on the stone, but it's something that is on my DNA and another not legally enforceable in the strict sense of it, but it's all.
It was just a question about why you thought conceptual framework, and you're saying you just want to see consistency between what's in the conceptual framework and ultimate.
That's a question of taste and how much you're going to put in the conceptual framework, how much you're going to understand it, but I believe it must be clear somewhere. If not here, understand it.
So, Gordon, do you have any unsolved problems left for us?
Where would I begin?
Regulation.
Control. I realize we have to go to 1 o'clock, and I'll fill the available time if you wish.
We can finish earlier, and then
I had a very nice lady partner who said that it's hard to try on a new hat when your pants are on fire. So my list is probably because my pants are on fire with a whole bunch of things. But the first one I'll start with was, and this is a wish list. We talked a lot about element uncertainty. How about entity uncertainty? It would be nice if we try to get further as a conceptual discussion the role of going concern in financial statement presentation and preparation. Right now, the stuff in the framework is not helpful at all, and there is enormous confusion as to what is the role of financial statements with respect to, does the entity exist? What's the unlikelihood or likelihood that it won't exist? Right at the center of the debate, Roger, and the stuff that you've been involved with and the Charman Commission and everything like that. This may be a standard setting question, but I think there needs to be a fuller discussion of going concern in the conceptual framework. And just as an aside, I think the path you're going down now at the standard set level is not helpful, the changes to
What is not helpful?
The changes you're proposing to IS-1.
IFRIC project coming up to us.
Yeah. Next thing is I was kind of hoping you'd have a more wholesome discussion in these papers on disclosure framework and the whole issue of disclosure overload. I know that's another one where everybody's pants are on fire and it's hard to know what the answer is, but one of the observations we've made is that all the debate seems to start with a different premise as to who the observer believes are the characteristics of the user that financial statements are targeted at. A more thorough discussion of the assumptions as to how much work a user is assumed to put into understanding the financial statements would help perhaps get that debate a little bit further down the road. But that also is a raging debate and is a black eye for the entire standing setting community in the world. All these outrageous comments made about disclosure overload and things like that.
So you got your pants on fire and a black eye on.
Yeah, exactly. I guess one more thing is one of the papers talks about the fact that financial statements are an aggregation and a summarization and that they're subtotals. And if you really think about our discussion of debt equity and our discussion of OCI versus net income P&L, that's really a debate about what subtotals are you permitted to have in financial statements and what's below a subtotal and what's above a subtotal. There are other subtotals that are just raging debates right now where there is not necessarily clear concepts. We're having all sorts of problems in Canada applying current versus long-term definitions to liabilities. We are getting innumerable requests from our regulator to override IFRS and prohibit certain subtotals in the income statement. They've had to write rules that are just arbitrary on what is an acceptable subtotal in the income statement, what titles are acceptable in the income statement, and there's no concepts as to, you know, what is acceptable, what is the aggregation basis in the income statement. And the other one that's interesting, there's no discussion in the conceptual framework as to the decision you would make as to whether items in the income statement should be summarized in terms of nature or function. It just seems to be an absolute free choice in IS-1 that you go one way or the other, but isn't there some sort of a concept that would be useful to discuss with respect to that type of a presentation issue?
Well, is there another stone that needs to be...
give us time to ask question.
No. I must say that this whole discussion, the number of issues that have been raised is just enormous. And they're all the leftover questions in financial accounting that our predecessors have not been able to answer. And there is a lot of diversity opinion around the table as well. So we have to be very careful with what kind of expectations people can reasonably have from this exercise. I think it's very useful to have this whole inventory, but I think we have to make some very clear choices about what we can handle and what we cannot handle and what perhaps may have to be postponed for a later stage. Because I am a bit, I don't know how overwhelmed the staff feels, but there's only so much that we can do.
Yeah, can I echo that and maybe remind you of something I said yesterday, which is I think the approach we've gone for is to go with a package. I was going to say relatively complete, but maybe after some of the comments you might not think is necessarily that complete. But I think it's a package of things where we think we can make reasonable progress in a reasonable time. And it's not going to be answering every question. And the DP we're aiming for at the moment is certainly not even trying to answer every question that we will try and deal with in the ED. And I said yesterday that I'd set us a budget of a maximum of sort of 15 to 20 questions, because I think it's not just about our capacity to develop it, but it's also about people's capacity to respond to this DP, to give us some good input and move on to the next stage of the discussion. So I think some of the questions that have been raised are probably our standards level issues. Some of them are probably issues for the ED of the framework. One or two of them might be ones that we need to think about a bit more before the DP. But I think as well, what we want to do at this stage is move forward, get the DP out and get the discussion started. So we need to make sure we've got the right package of high level issues to contribute to that objective of getting the discussion going.
I agree with that, Peter, but one expectation that's got to be managed over time based on past history is that when you have a major review of the framework, which has only happened twice in my working career, they tend to get to a painful stage at the end and, you know, victory is declared and we leave. You've got to be careful, I think, to keep saying to people that it is an iterative process between the framework and the standards in both directions. Otherwise, you know, I can see us in a year or two's time saying, well, that was 2 years of pain. We don't want to go back there for another 20 years. That's what we have done in the past. How can we avoid doing that this time?
Now, I have three questions, but only one very short response. One relates to what Francois mentioned about the economic compulsion, and the board discussed twice, I think, or three times publicly, and last month's, you know, staff proposed and generally got support from board members to take the alternative of a B approach, and there are three alternatives. And basically staff say, you know, the follow the Facebook presentation substance over form, they use economic substance notions to take the ideas economic compulsion, and Francois, whether you agree or not, to that direction, you know. And second to Leslie, you mentioned about we should discuss about derecognition. And several years ago, we jointly published ED, derecognition.
It was a discussion paper, right?
Oh, discussion paper. Yeah. And the proposed views are basically, you know, people not accept. You know, people generally accept the alternative view. And in your view, whether we should follow the alternative views or follow the proposed view, basically. My third question relates to God. You mentioned about the subtotal, and there are two approaches to, you know, to go. One approach is, you know, we set principles, but leave to management, just like our financial statement presentation, original proposal, you know. Even though we propose cohesiveness and disaggregation, but give management the freedom. And alternatively, we should have a very clear and very restricted descriptions and what's your orientation. So I don't want a, you know, very detailed response, but general and really summarized response.
Well, I don't have much more to say. I mean, these early discussions have been held in one day, and so it's been very preliminary views provided. When we discussed the or watched more than discussed that. The approach to liabilities, in fact, there was some support for approach two at this stage. As I said, we were not really able to assess the merits of approach three. And so in that approach two, and there is a link with your question of looking only at what has commercial substance, may solve most of the issues. I don't know whether it does or it does not, but it's certainly heading into the right direction.
My remarks should not be taken as suggesting that you should include a preliminary view in this document. I think this is a very difficult issue, derecognition. And so my suggestion was rather to try and put a little bit more explanation about why somebody in looking at a derecognition issue might decide only to disclose, or might disclose to do a components approach, et cetera. I think just to amplify it a little bit,
I think that the recent trend in standard setting toward using control as the basis for derecognition and remeasurement is being challenged. I think we saw it in revenue recognition where people said, well, wait a second, if there are risks and rewards retained, do you really want to sail there, et cetera. We certainly see it in the U.S. in our current standard on derecognition where little by little we have been whittling down the control concept. So just a little bit more color to help people think it through and maybe provide useful input so that when you do get to the next round, you're able to form a preliminary view.
Okay, any more questions or comments?
Hans, can I maybe actually add one
thing? Yes, please.
Three or four of you mentioned the debt equity split and the link to the proprietary concept or the entity concept. And I guess I just wanted to draw out the contrast of what we're doing under IAS 32 at the moment. Because under IAS 32, we're classifying some things as liabilities when there isn't an obligation to pay. And the classic example is where you're using your own shares as currency to pay a liability. So for those of you who are concerned about the approach we're looking at, maybe is that a step back from the entity concept? I don't think it is, actually. I mean, I think it's actually more consistent with the entity concept. Because what we're saying is there are two things that are interest. One is cash going to leave the entity? That's clearly an entity view. And then is there an effect on the shareholders? Now, there is an effect on the shareholders, and IAS 32 tries to avoid structuring by saying, well, if two things have the same effect on the shareholders, then put them both through P&L. So I think what we're trying to do is sort of, in a way, bridge between the two concepts by separating clearly what's the entity part of the view. Is there going to be cash outflow or not? From what's the effect on the shareholders?
But using that specific example, that was one case where I didn't see how it solved the problem that had been identified. It was saying that, for all intents and purposes, a cash-settled stock option and a stock-settled stock option are the same. In one case, you remeasure through P&L, and in the other, you don't. I thought you were saying by remeasuring it through equity, you've solved the problem. And to me, the fact that one goes through P&L and the other doesn't is the crux of the issue. So it hadn't been solved.
Well, if you define solved as it must have the same effect on P&L, then clearly it doesn't solve it. If you define solved as you've reported information where people can see the equivalence but they can also see the difference, then arguably it does solve it. And obviously there'll be different views about that.
The alternative view is that if it genuinely is equity, why are you remeasuring it?
Right, but then you have that problem with 32 already.
Oh, yeah. 32, I think, is indefensible, other than through purely as an attempt to contain some what was perceived to be abuse.
Well, we finished a little bit early. That doesn't matter.